Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 176, Cooperstown. Last time out, we followed the story of Daniel Boone as a microcosm of the early westward expansion, initially as he travelled with Washington to the French Fort Duquesne, now Pittsburgh, and then through the foundation of Kentucky and later Missouri. We looked at how brutal, contradictory, and often unsatisfying the experience was. These will be themes that we'll come to again and again. This week, we're going to look at how the federal government was responding to the move west. Not for the first time, we are very fortunate to have the Federalist Papers. In them, Hamilton and Madison spell out their thinking in some depth, and of course, John Jay helped out. We can't forget Jay. In Federalist Paper 38, Madison goes on a bit of an excursion talking about the West, and I think it will be helpful for us to go through the passage. Quote, "Out of this lifeless mass has already grown an exuberant power, which tends to realise all the dangers that can be apprehended from a defective construction of the supreme government of the Union. It is now no longer a point of speculation and hope that the Western Territory is a mine of vast wealth to the United States, and although it is not of such a nature as to extricate them from their present distresses, or for some time to come, to yield any regular supplies for the public expenses, yet must it hereafter be able, under proper management, both to effect a gradual discharge of the domestic debt, and to furnish, for a certain period, liberal tributes to the Federal Treasury. A very large proportion of this fund has been already surrendered by individual states, and it may, with reason, be expected that the remaining states will not persist in withholding similar proofs of their equity and generosity. We may calculate, therefore, that a rich and fertile country, of an area equal to the inhabited extent of the United States, will soon become a national stock. Congress have assumed the administration of this stock. They have begun to render it productive. Congress have undertaken to do more. They have proceeded to form new states, to erect temporary governments, to appoint offices for them, and to prescribe the conditions on which such states shall be admitted into the Confederacy. All this has been done, and done without the least colour of constitutional authority. Yet no blame has been whispered, no alarm has been sounded. A great and independent fund of revenue is passing into the hands of a single body of men who can raise troops to an indefinite number and appropriate money to their support for an indefinite period of time. And yet there are men who have not only been silent spectators of this prospect, but who are advocates for the system which exhibits it, and, at the same time, urge against the new system the objections which we have heard. Would they not act with more consistency in urging the establishment of the latter as no less necessary to guard the Union against the future powers and resources of a body constructed like the existing Congress, than to save it from the dangers threatened by the present impotency of that assembly?" End quote. There are three things to note here. Firstly, the recognition that the migration was already underway by this point. Madison was writing in 1787-1788, over a decade after the founding of Boonesborough. Secondly, the sense of opportunity that the West presented. The phrase, "a mine of vast wealth to the United States," is very telling. And thirdly, the sense of potential fear that dominates the latter end of this passage. In the Constitution, a new system was set up for the expansion of the Union, and part of this is an attempt to ensure that the Atlantic states would not be overwhelmed by those of the interior. Hamilton echoed this in a private letter in May 1790, when he wrote to the West, quote, "should be in great measure settled from abroad, rather than the entire expense of the Atlantic population," end quote. Jay wrote in 1787, quote, The Western country will one day give us trouble. To govern them will not be easy. End quote. This was something to be done at a controlled pace, ideally in partnership with the Indians through land purchases and assimilation. But, as should be obvious from last time, this was a pipe dream. By 1790, Tennessee and Kentucky had a combined population of over 100,000. The original plan of centrally organised townships with land sold at a high price wasn't going to work. Nearly a century of bloody conflict would follow the westward scramble. One of the key trends at the end of the 18th century was the prominence of land speculation companies. The Ohio Company, a joint stock company made up of former officers from the Continental Army, paid Congress $1 million in 1787 for 1.5 million acres of land north of the Ohio River, with an option for purchasing an additional 4.5 million acres for the Sciosso Company. This prompted other offers. John Cleve Sims, a judge from New Jersey, acquired 1 million acres near the modern Cincinnati, while the Connecticut Land Company purchased 3 million acres near Cleveland. These companies were funded by Easterners, usually ones who had made their wealth in trade, who now wanted to retire into a landed aristocracy to become English gentlemen. Many men who we've dealt with already had followed this path, including John Hancock, Henry Lawrence, Elbridge Gerry, Henry Knox, James Wilson, and Robert Morris. Land speculation was respectable, trade was not. And this also represented another severing of America from the Atlantic world. For many, this approach would prove financially ruinous, but some would achieve success, such as William Cooper, the father of the novelist James Fenimore Cooper. Cooper was born in the 1750s in Pennsylvania, became a storekeeper, and in the mid-1780s, he and a partner started buying shares in a defunct land company which held tens of thousands of acres in upstate New York. It was a very complicated legal process, so Cooper hired the best lawyer around, Alexander Hamilton. Cooper moved quickly, selling land to speculators and developing a town which he named Cooperstown. It was a high-risk strategy, but it paid off. By the 1790s, he was both the richest man in the region and an international celebrity and expert of American land speculation. He received requests to help and advice, even from Europe. While I suspect Cooper would have claimed skill and business knew as the reason for his success, and they would have played a part, he was also spectacularly lucky in being at the right place at the right time. America was experiencing a population boom, particularly in New England. After the peace with the British, the Iroquois either moved north or west, and the Vermont question had been settled. Upstate New York was suddenly both safe and close. The price of land was increasing, so moving now made sense before it got even more expensive. Upstate New York became one of the fastest growing areas in the country. Cooper took advantage of this by moving quickly and was able to build up a critical mass of population quickly, something which would be crucial for any attempt at creating a new settlement. This part was the luck factor, but Cooper also displayed significant wisdom too. He wanted the settlement to succeed, and realised that for this, he needed settlers to invest in the project. To use the old quote attributed to the Roman Emperor Tiberius, "It is the duty of a good shepherd to shear his sheep, not skin them." So, how did Cooper achieve this? Rather than trying to make a quick cash grab and keeping the settlers as tenants, Cooper sold the land as freehold, modestly priced on long-term credit. He also didn't hoard the best land, but sold that too. It meant that the new settlers had the opportunity to thrive and would benefit from improving their own land. He also knew that to drive this, he would have a much greater impact if he were there in person. he relocated himself to Cooperstown with his family. There would be trouble in the future for Cooperstown, but it was one of the success stories of the 1790s. While circumstances had been favourable, it was Cooper's focus on settlement rather than speculation that made Cooperstown a success. Others would not be so successful. The foundational issue is that most speculation plans were fantasy. In theory, the federal government would sell a large tract of land to speculators. This was for a lump sum. The speculators would then subdivide the land into smaller plots and sell them as farms. This gave the government a lump sum without needing to deal with thousands of small buyers. The farmers would be able to buy a manageable tract of land, and the speculators would make a profit by providing this service to both parties. This all made sense in theory, but it was a fantasy. There was simply too much land and too few people. There was always cheaper land, so speculators raced to the bottom, offering lower and lower prices. Some sold portions of land at lower prices, hoping to recoup some losses, and then the settlement would drive up the price of the land they kept. But it didn't work, because there was always more land. The Ohio Company, you'll recall, purchased 1 million acres for $1 million. They intended to make a profit on this. But there were rumours of a new release of land in the Ohio being sold by Congress for 25 cents an acre, so nobody in their right mind would pay $1 an acre. And that was for those that paid. Many simply showed up and built settlements. If the squatter settlements were destroyed by soldiers, then the squatters would wait for them to leave, then rebuild. John Sims, the New Jersey judge who purchased 1 million acres around Cincinnati, fell behind on payments and ended up returning most of the land. But that's nothing compared to the disaster that fell the Sciosso Company. The Sciosso Company, you recall, worked with the Ohio Company. It was founded by William Dewar, Hamilton's assistant treasury secretary, and it planned on selling land in the Ohio Valley to French speculators. However, this process of finding settlers was given to agents who not only sold the land to artisans, not the source of people who would make good frontier farmers, but also sold the land the company had no rights to. They founded a settlement called Gallipoli with around 500 French settlers, almost all of whom were either killed or fled because of disease and Indian attack. The company collapsed in 1792, and by 1806, only 16 of the original families were still there. The settlement was simply too small to survive. If you think back to the early episodes on Jamestown and Plymouth, it took the population reaching the thousands before things finally stabilised. But the Americans had not learned from the British. Instead, small groups roamed around, breaking Indian treaties and continuing the endless cycle of Indian settler violence. This is where we'll leave things for this week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.